2017, 7 avril, l'Orge du Next Step. Avec nous ce soir, un artiste originaire de la multiculturelle explosive Nouvelle-Orléans, le représentant de la stretch music, un style unique de musique qui définit l'essence même de cet art, le partage entre différents genres et la création collective de mélodies, rythmes et harmonies. Son plus récent projet discographique, The Centennial Trilogy, est une série de 3 albums qui célèbre le centenaire des premiers enregistrements de musique jazz. Le premier album, Blue Rebel, vient d'être publié et ici notre invité réévalue la réalité sociopolitique du monde actuel à travers le pouvoir du son. Ladies and gentlemen, Christian Scott at Tunde and Joa. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Do you understand a bit of what I said?
A little bit.
A little bit. Okay. So as said in introduction, your new album, Ruler Rebel, is out. It's the first of the trilogy. The Diaspora is going to fall in summer, and then the Emancipation Procrastination is going to fall in the fall.
Right, fall and fall.
Exactly. I have a question about the title. Doesn't the word rebel imply a disrespect of rules? So why
do
you call the ruler
level? So in New Orleans, there's a long history of standing of men that are chiefs in the Afro-Native American culture are called rulers because they are essentially the chiefs or big chiefs or rulers of their neighborhoods, right? So this is where the ruler comes from. But rebel, it's not intended to imply a disrespect so much as it is intended to imply a space where you do not acquiesce or fall or yield into concerns of oppressors, right? In the place that I live, there are very subversive and oppressive forces that, you know, if I'm being completely honest with you, deny resources to certain proponents of the population in Louisiana and New Orleans. There is rampant food insecurity. There are people that are being undereducated so they can be a labor class. There's a problem with the prison industrial system. So if I were to fall in line with agreeing with these rules, then essentially I would be also accepting this idea and this notion that the people that are like me are inferior and that they are made to serve others. So this is something that I completely disagree with. So in this sense, then yes, I would say I'm a pretty rebellious person. Warfare in all first world nations, right? So when you speak of the European Union as an example, the overwhelming majority of the nations that are in this union, you could argue, are pretty first world, right? So when you go into these places and you see how people interact on a societal level, as a black person navigating these spaces as a world citizen, I still see the same types of tropes and the same types of actions that you see in America. It's just that the laws here and the way that people deal with the legislative part of this dynamic is very different, right? Because one could argue that America may pass a law that says people have civil rights, but it may be 40 years before you start to actually see these rights actually in place, right? The voting rights. You think of, in the American Republic at one point, you know, blacks were given the right to vote very early on in their emancipation. But if they tried to vote, they would be killed, right? So it becomes about a different piece of the process, right? It becomes about when you say you're going to do something and you're addressing something that is a societal ill or something that is harming your country or the heart, the soul, the spirit of the country, then it becomes about actually addressing these issues in a way that are accurate, but also addressing the issues in a way that makes sure that everyone benefits, right? If the only beneficiaries of civil rights action are white supremacists, then it didn't work, Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so if my daughter cannot go to school with anyone that she wants to go to, as an example, in 1954, right? Then yes, obviously there are issues there that need to be addressed. But once they're addressed, she shouldn't go to school and have grown men throwing potatoes at her and calling her nigger. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, right. But to act as if this is only an American problem also can be very dangerous, right? Because culturally and socially, you don't live in an experience where you are surrounded by people that look different than you. And depend, like, if you live in a big city, that's one thing. But if you live in a countryside, you may not know that you have racist tendencies or views, or you may not know that you have xenophobic tendencies or views. You may not know that you have a problem with transgender or gay people because you don't have to see them.
Because you
right?
never know. You never
right.
really existed.
Exactly. Yeah. So once you're confronted with that, then you're in a space where you have to sort of look in the mirror and try and identify what the issue is and then go about the work of fixing it. But a lot of these issues that I speak to are not, I don't hold the view that people are inherently bad or evil or any of these things. I think that when people are exposed to things and people are open to certain things and their exposure to them shows them that their feelings or their thoughts or the things that they've been taught are maybe not accurate, then they can go about the business of starting to break those things down and to become better. Right? But it isn't pointed in a direction that says this is right or this is wrong, because, you know, I think of it like music, right? When someone gets a trumpet and they're 7 years old, they don't know what they don't know yet. It's up to someone that has more information to say, okay, this is how you do this, this is how this is navigated, and these are the things you want to look out for, because everyone is a beginner at some point. Right? So to just conclude that people are inherently bad or good is to me, I think this is callous and also negligent. Right?
It is absolutely, yeah. Because we can just see when kids are at school, they all like each other, and then somebody's saying, no, actually, wait, because she's a girl, you know, don't
right.
touch her like that,
right.
Or he's a black person from that
right.
little neighborhood,
right.
pay attention.
Right.
And the kids are like, ah, okay, but then I have to do it. And it's
right.
just absolutely...
Kind
that's
of
why,
absurd.
That's
yeah.
why I like talking up to you about that, because you're mm-hmm. a musician, you're a great musician, but also
Thank
you're
you.
A good messenger.
Thank you.
That's what I like about the concept of the stretch music, mm-hmm. because it's not only a musical concept, but it's it represents the engagement mm-hmm. of as a jazzman, because it's not only that we are engaged in music, but also in social, political, and educational issues, and the stretch music, this concept, covers any genre of music. And that's what, for me, is jazz, what actually means. It's mm-hmm. a music where musicians on stage are engaged in delivering an excellent product, not mainstream, but excellent music. And the audience is engaged, because it's not easy listening, let's admit that. So it's not all groove and melody, but also that it needs a certain knowledge beforehand. So what I'm going to say is more a statement, more than a question, so just feel free to share your thoughts. When we say music is a universal language, I would just say more that jazz is, because you can't label it,
mm-hmm.
you can't categorize. It is a common language of freedom since its origins from slavery with the blues.
Mm-hmm.
It's been always a form of expression against all forms of oppression, and that's what we see in jam sessions in a way.
Sure.
Like there was 2 days ago or 3 days ago, there was Maris Motley who came by to one of the little cavour here in the Key Jazz to jam with some people from Switzerland, and it was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You see this connection, they were just beginning to know each other by playing, somebody did a solo, another one did another solo, and then it just ended up in a big party, everybody was super excited,
right.
and that's what jazz means for me.
Mm.
This kind of like breaking up of barriers, and what I think that's what you do.
I couldn't have put it more beautifully, honestly. I think the way that you've synthesized the tenets and the ideas that exist in this culture of music is perfect, actually. I know you're interviewing me, but that was very well done.
But for example, like in the last trilogy, I read that you were mixing up some different genre music, like even African and West African music with hip hop, rap, jazz, and or Asian music. So,
sure.
Can you, for example, the Rural Rumble, what would you say is the most famous?
The most mixed.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hard.
With the coronation of
the
10th,
I
think that is kind of very cheery.
This one is very layered, has a lot of layers. I'm going to start tonight's concert with that. Also, Ruler Rebel has a lot of stuff because they are pipas and irhu. There's instruments from the Pan-Asian instruments. Clearly, there's West African instruments. Dun dun, kini kini, samba, djembe, bata. All these things are in this song. Also, trap. I actually think it's Ruler Rebel.
Okay.
It's just the way everything marries, the marriage is more perfect, okay. Right? Whereas in coronation is more disparate.
You had a very long career, but not long career, sorry. Mm. Rewind it.
Rewind that, yeah.
Actually, in a quite a short period of your musical career, you already published around 8 albums as a leader, not only the collaboration, just as a leader. Yeah. And journalists always like to talk in superlative terms. Mm. What would you say was your most satisfying album? There's no way, of course.
It's like asking somebody, which child of yours do you like the most, right? They may have an opinion, right? They may be like, I kind of like Jason more than Branford. All right. Right? I don't know. Right? But they would never say, because, you know, obviously there's emotional realities connected to the records. And where I was in all of those moments is very valid. I obviously like stretch music a lot because that's my babies. That's the baby band. That's like Elena and Braxton, and they were so young. And for them to be able to do what they did at such, when they were like 18, 19 years old, is like mind boggling. But I've also always had an affinity for Yesterday You Said Tomorrow. Mm. But that's really more because of Rudy Mangelder.
Yeah.
And him coming out of retirement to make a record with us was just the sweetest thing.
Talking about instrument, mm-hmm. I'm super fascinated by your trumpet.
Okay.
So you play lots of brass instruments, corn, flugelhorn, trumpet, and even the soprano trombone, I read, right?
Mm-hmm, okay. Yeah. So. I'm not very good at that one, though. Okay. It's cool. I can play a couple melodies. No, it's cool. I'm honest.
Why am I fascinated by your instrument, not only the sound, but also the shape?
I think
everybody tells you that. Mm. Can you describe it to the audience?
The one that I play the most is a tilted bell trumpet, which is like this one, right? Which a lot of people, when they see it, they say, oh, Dizzy Gillespie. But what the horn actually does is the exact opposite of what Dizzy's horn does. The shape looks similar. So people that don't play the instrument say, oh, it looks like Dizzy Gillespie.
Because you have to label it.
No, I understand it, right? For some reason, right? But the last angle of the trumpet bell in Dizzy Gillespie's horn, you have the same last angle, and then there's one extra angle at a 45-degree angle. This gives you more back pressure, makes it a little easier to play in the upper register, but pinches the sound of the horn. My horn in the last angle, there's one less angle, and the angle is less abrasive. It's about 22 degrees. So it allows me to get multiple timbres inside the same instrument. So I can play one horn, but I can get the sound of 4 or 5 different horns. So I don't really need to switch horns so much. I also have one that's here tonight. It's called the reverse flugelhorn. This one is like a flugel with 2 really big shepherd's crook in it that darkens the sound a lot. But it also allows me to play in the upper register of the instrument in a way that you cannot play in the flugelhorn. So these are the main 2 I tour with.
And how many do you own, actually? At least the Adams instrument,
the Adams ones, maybe 10? Wow. 10 or 11 Adams ones, yeah.
So how long does it take to make one of them? Right? Because
it depends. The guy that makes them is genius, so yeah. I can call him today and say, I need a new horn in 2 days, and he can have a new horn that is custom built, beautiful, gold plated, everything in a couple days.
Okay. When did you meet him?
At the North Sea Jazz Festival.
Okay.
I was hanging out with a guy named Amik, mm-hmm. who was an incredible Cuban trumpet player. And he was telling me, because the horn that I have today is my first, this is the first one that I ever did that to. Mm-hmm. It's an old one. And at the time, I wasn't really feeling it. And the company that I was working with was very good, but it took them a very long time to make the horns, and the materials were strong, but there were issues. And when I met Mill, he's like, look, you know, I want to create completely new instruments if you're open to that. And I'm like, well, this is exactly what I want to do. And so we started working on some prototypes, and when he sent them, they were just out of this world.
I think it's
not
the only one in the world that's the same.
No, they're different. They're like Enderbeinen makes an interesting horn. Lawler, I mean, there's a lot of companies that make different horns. The thing is that usually their experimental horns are ones that are like, people will have just as like art pieces and this type of stuff, but they aren't really, the great players don't really play them.
Okay.
So I think the difference with Neil is I think he's the best, but I think it's also because I take the horn all over the globe. People see the visibility of the horn is different.
Okay. So, some of the songs they're composed by different metals. Mm-hmm. What the difference of the metals bring to
So if you have a nickel plated guy, that one's gonna have a different ring. I like gold plated horns because they're darker sounding. Mm-hmm. You have like white gold or silver, this is a little brighter. But I always prefer like dark sounding horns, because my trumpet teacher is a guy named Clyde Kerr Jr. When I was growing up, he played a silver box Stradivarius. I played a lacquered one, but because I learned from him, my sound is naturally a little brighter. I can warm it up, but having the gold gives it a really brilliant, warm, beautiful sound. So this is what I prefer.
It's super interesting. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think time is up because unfortunately I will talk to you for hours.
Oh, that's really sweet.
But you have to go to
the concert. Yeah, I gotta get a little ready.
Okay. Yeah, so thank you so much for
this. Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Oh.